And this is KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, Washington. And welcome. Welcome to Through Science to Health. And this is one of our alternating Friday programs at 12:10 at KPTZ. And joining me today, this is Chris Bricker, and joining me today is Lynn Sorensen, RN. A retired, longtime community member of Port Townsend, and an advocate for public health awareness and promotion. And Lynn is a member of KPTZ's Virus Watch, an emergency response team. And she offers information and commentary on the current COVID-19 pandemic response during interviews every other Friday this summer. From science, through science to health. Lynn Sorensen, welcome, and as usual, lots to talk about today.
Yeah.
Generally, I think let's start out with some general statistics. I know that, unfortunately, nearly all of Washington State is on the path to runaway transmission rates of the COVID-19. Public health officials have warned this week that more infections are found per day than ever before. So, how do we stand? How do we stand in the state, and what are we looking at nationwide right now?
Well, as of the 23rd, yesterday in Jefferson County, we had almost 4,500 tests have been done, and there were 60 pending, and we're still sitting at 50 as far as positive cases. But a very troubling number is that the United States in 15 days went from 3 million to 4 million confirmed cases. I mean, it's too fast. And that just means it could be doubling even more or continuing to go up. And daily deaths have surpassed 1,000 for the third consecutive days. So,
well, if anybody doesn't understand how compound interest works, then let's take a look at this.
Yeah, and Britain too. They finally, as of today, have a mandatory mask rule in place. But it was announced like 10 days ago that it was coming, and they were saying, "Well, why not start it now?" Because they have had more deaths. They're the third highest death count globally after Brazil and the United States. But for some reason, Boris Johnson said that as of today, that's when they would do mandatory masking. So it certainly is not great news, but it's good that they're finally having people wear masks. And the, and the death count exceeds 141,000 in the United States, with 66,000 new cases each day. I mean, I think last time we talked, it was maybe 50,000 cases each day. Now it's over 66,000.
Let's see. And if you took an average arena fully packed, which is probably anywhere from 17 to 20,000 people, and then multiply that out or divide, you know, you get a pretty good visual on how many people have died. Or how many cases there are out there.
And how many cases daily. Yeah. And I read this morning that in one particular Texas hospital that their ICU beds are full, and they're actually saying they're going to send patients home to die with their families, those that they know won't likely come out of this, and so that they're not dying by themselves in a room. But still, someone has to make that decision. So who am I going to send home? I mean, it just sounds like a very difficult thing to do. But it's the reality where, you know, they think they can save others. But I wouldn't want to have to make that decision.
I know. Just a tremendous amount of pressure on our health medical professionals. Mm-hmm. You know, it's one thing to be in a disaster situation where you're trying to triage people, but then, you know, you're in this situation where you're just flat out overcrowded because we haven't been able to flatten the curve and keep it there. It's pretty tragic. So it leads me to my next question, which is, you know, there are There's talk, and then there are actual quarantine requirements from hotspot to hotspot. And what's happening? As I understand it, maybe about 22 states have quarantine requirements for people coming in out of the area?
Yeah, and let's see, I think I was looking at some today, and Connecticut is one that could have a $1,000 fine if you haven't done your come in and quarantine for 14 days, and I don't know if that's $1,000 one time or per day or whatever, but New Jersey, New York, I think Maine too, you know, they don't want travelers from outside of their states, especially from the hot spots, and Washington is considered a hot spot. And on the West Coast, Oregon is one state that is not a hot spot. And on the 22nd, the Oregon governor was considering restrictions limiting tourism coming from other hot spot states. So I don't know what that's going to mean, but it's not been announced yet. So I don't think they are one of the states that has the 14-day requirement, but still, it's, you know, how are they going to stop people from coming in?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, there's airports, and then there's Interstate 5.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, Washington is considered a hotspot and one of those infected areas. And so what happens? People desiring to leave the state to go to head south, for example, or even just to go to the airport. How is that all going to work out?
Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
But they are, you know, definitely realities that are changing very quickly out there for travel, for just all kinds of things.
I know New York State has a potential $2,000 fine, but, you know, how do you enforce that? I know there are enforcement teams, and there are travel advisories and all the rest of that mostly to the airports, I would reckon, or bus stations, and then filling out traveler health forms and that kind of thing. There's certain criteria. Better that than nothing, I suppose.
Yeah, it'd be like when you fly to Hawaii, you always have to fill out, you know, just various things on that questionnaire. And then they usually ask for contact information, and that may become, and I don't usually fill that out, but, you know, maybe that's a mandatory thing now so they can track where you're going and that you're supposed to stay there, you know, because Hawaii is one of the earliest ones to have a 14-day quarantine.
Yeah,
from out-of-state travelers.
Where you're going, who you're going to see. I mean, I think it's for contact tracing. I think that's probably pretty important.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Well, that brings us to vaccines. Vaccines, you know, we're full speed ahead on the vaccine front. Warp speed. I know that there are... you know, the relaxations of certain requirements ordinarily would take place, and just sort of multiple clinical trials going on of different vaccine developers and researchers, so mm-hmm. that simultaneously we can keep things going without having to just wait for one to finish and another one to start. So what's that looking like out there right now?
Well, there are some hopeful things on the horizon, and I remember this pharmaceutical company, it's like Moderna, was coming out with what they're calling an mRNA vaccine. So RNA is a nucleic acid found in all living cells, and it's a messenger, and that's where the M comes from. But this is actually proving to be a possibility as far as getting vaccines made more quickly than usual. They are now in what they're calling a phase 2 trial, actually using this on humans. They're finding that it'll probably take at least 2 doses of it to get a good immune response, which could be problematic, because if it was a 1 dose, that way everyone would show up for their 1 dose. But getting people back for a 2nd dose has always proved to be difficult. It is safer because it's not made from any kind of particles or inactivated pathogens from the actual virus, so it's non-infectious. And it also can be produced more rapidly than standardized vaccines. But they're also discovering that storage has to be either frozen or refrigerated, and that would be very problematic, say, in countries that don't have refrigeration available. So while it has some good things coming, it's still definitely in its, you know, early phases. And I'm just concerned about the proprietary vaccines. You know, people that have spent the money on it are going to keep those rather than giving it to the world. And if they are given to the world, what will the cost be to the many countries that won't be able to afford it? I was looking at the polio vaccine that Jonas Salk developed, and he said there would be no patent on this, that this vaccine belonged to the world. So there was no patent back in, 1950 on the polio vaccine, and all countries could access it and make it. But I know that the United States has gone ahead, this is in the United Kingdom and also in France, and actually paid lots of money in advance to get early access to whatever vaccine is developed, and has secured first access to the French company, Sanofi, so that United States citizens would get this even before the citizens of that country. So there will be definitely unequal access, but for this kind of for a pandemic, this threatens people everywhere. I mean, I think distribution, along with being able to afford the vaccine once developed, is definitely going to be a very big ball of wax. I mean, it's just a sticky wicket, and access to medicines, you know, they shouldn't be based on pay, even though that's how it all works. You know, it should be an ethical one and not a scientific one. Who gets the medication?
Well, we're dealing with the common good here. And, you know, and I'm also thinking, I'm also thinking in terms of certain populations that are more susceptible to the virus because of lack of nutrition or whatever it might happen to be. So we need to be careful there. Need to be careful in our attitudes towards what we consider to be the benefit of society in general. That's my take on it. Yeah,
I remember make the difference, you know.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid. You know, that was during the polio epidemic, and when you were talking about that, the thought occurred to me, man, you know, how many things I just took for granted as sort of being the daily routine, as you know, when you're really little and people are talking about pandemics or solutions and all the rest of that stuff, or even kids these days, you know, sort of just the sort of like the daily thing. Okay, well, this is what we got to do when we go out. We have to wear a mask, and you sort of take that as a part and parcel of what you got to do every day. But the vaccines to me were sort of along that thinking as well, as you know, just the simplicity of a child saying, okay, we got to do this, and we got to go take this vaccine on a sugar cube, or however the hell we did it. And that also makes me think about, you know, what are we going to encounter with resistance to certain people that are resistant to vaccinations, and how that's all going to work out.
Well, if we can get 70% of the whole world vaccinated, then we'll have herd immunity. So imagine how difficult that's going to be.
Yeah.
It's just the mechanism of getting those getting that done. I mean, it's just incredible to think about.
It's a big effort, but you know, we went through World War II and we landed somebody on the moon. So it just seems to me that if we put our minds to something, we can do it. You know, it's just that it's a mammoth undertaking for humanity.
Yeah, and one article I was reading was, you know, because the cost for creating these vaccines are very, very high, and of course the companies that create them want to get their financial return. But one article I read was suggesting that instead of having this, for the companies to get something maybe other than all the financial return, is for governments to create an international prize to, say, award funds to the companies based on the lives saved by their COVID drugs or vaccines, that you're making it, you know, just making it a different, you know, it's like Academy Awards, you know, this company did such and such, and they're highlighted as saving the world. Or, I mean, that's very good PR, but is that enough, you know, to...
For an incentive,
to make it less costly for the rest of us.
Yeah, well, sort of, that's sort of like a Nobel Prize on steroids.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, it would be.
Well, we have a couple of minutes left, and I think we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about back to school. You know, we could go on for another half hour with that, but the back to school issues and the whole controversy about just to what degree are children carriers of the virus and all the rest of that. Do you have any recent information about that? I think people are still sort of in a quandary, and I think that's part of...
Oh, it is a quandary. Yeah, I read today that they thought, well, maybe children 10 and under aren't as quite, you know, going to be the carriers of this, but I don't know where they'd get that information from. And there's already a number of school districts that are saying, you know, we're going to start online. You know, it's going to be virtual school, and that's, I think, the Seattle School District has already decided that, as well as in Bellevue. So those are some very big districts over in King County. But across the nation, I know a number of, at least probably more eastern states, start their schools in August. And they are already coming up with, you know, we've got to start school virtually. I mean, the risk for the teachers and the staff...
Yeah, because there's no proven protocol for testing the staff right now. I mean, the planning part of it, and it's just sort of like the part that puts us in the dark is something that, I know that there are so many drawbacks to the economy, to people's jobs, to risk factors, and at home, and... what the benefit is for children staying at home as opposed to getting out there and socializing in a scholastic atmosphere. But we have all of these things to consider, so it's just not going to be an easy kind of thing. But I think that, we need to remember that the people that we rely on every day, the teachers, are varying degrees of age and aging. And they are the people, they are the heroes. They are the people that are taking care of our kids on a day-to-day basis. I mean, I think back, and I remember the name of my third grade teacher. Now, why is that?
Well, that was probably an exceptional teacher.
Yeah. Either visually or otherwise, who knows, I just thought about that, that's a very valuable resource that we need to protect, because they are the people that literally take care of our kids most of the week when you stop to think about it.
Yeah, right. I come from a family of teachers, and, I know how much difference a teacher can make in a kid's life, to be the inspiration that they're maybe not getting anywhere else, to try harder, to, read more, to whatever. And I think we've probably all had teachers in our past that have done just that, to inspire you to do more than you would have maybe normally. But deciding how to do the schooling, I mean, I'm glad my kids are grown now. I think it's just be very difficult. I wouldn't want to be the parent sending my young kid off to school. But then if I had to be working and then also have to do homeschooling, I mean, I don't know how people are going to do it that do have children in schools, because it is such a stretch always.
Well, I think the moral of everything is that we need to move cautiously and wisely, and it ain't going to be perfect. But, you know, God bless the child. That's all I have to say. Well, listen, Lynn, we've gone over a little bit, but that's okay. Lynn Sorensen, RN, retired, longtime community member of Port Townsend and an advocate for public health awareness and promotion. And she is a member of our KPTZ Virus Watch and Emergency Response Team. And we're so happy to have you once again. We will talk again
Thank
in a
you,
couple
Chris.
Of weeks from
okay.
through science to health. Our
yeah, I'm going to spit that that name out because it's hard to say, through science to health.
Yeah, I got it finally.
Got it, yeah. Okay,
bye-bye. All right, well, thank you so much, Lynn. And we will be rejoining, we'll be joining Counterspin, already in progress. And everybody stay tuned for Paul Rice coming up with Filter at 1 o'clock. Thank you, Lynn.
Okay. Yeah, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.